episode 19 of the Board Game Geek podcast, where we geek out about board games, the mechanisms behind them, and the people who create them. I'm your host, Candace Harris, and I'm super excited to be here today with another awesome game designer and a good friend, Erica Bulyaris. How's it going today, Erica?
It's good. It's good. Working on a bunch of stuff right now, which is nice. Wrapping up a bunch of things for fall 24 to jump into spring 25.
Awesome.
And I guess the most fun thing right now is my Dumb Ways to Die game is actually just hitting shelves, I believe.
Ooh, tell me about that.
So if you guys know the lovely campaign that went viral, a few decades now ago, Dumb Ways to Die got turned into apps and all kinds of stuff. It's back. It's back in card form. And it's an exploding deck game with lenticular cards, so you can actually watch your beans die. But your goal is actually to keep them alive, so try really hard to do that too.
Cool. Well, I just got back like about a week ago from BGG Spring, and I had such a great time. I mean, I always do. Every time I go to the BGG conventions, I have a great time because they're just, you know, they're mostly about like open gaming, which I love.
It's all about gaming. Yeah,
exactly. And it's also like BGG Spring is just such a like a chill kind of environment. Like this one, families, you can like bring kids to it. So there are a lot of like parents bringing their kids. And I don't know, it's just like a really nice environment. Everyone's so friendly and there's like a lot of positivity in the air. And it's always like exciting for me, especially because I get to like actually see and hang out and play games with like some of the BGG crew, because like we all live pretty much in different states. So I got to play like an epic, fun, and hilarious Station Fall game with Aldi, which is like one of his recent favorite games. And then I played Tribes of the Wind for the first time with Beth. I really liked that. And she had like really liked it a lot and was like, hey, we've got to show you this game. So that was cool. And then also I played Big Boss with Eric, which is like it's just about to come back out from Funko Games. But this was like one of those games I remember hearing like so many people rave about, but it's been out of print forever.
I don't think I got to play this one.
It's pretty cool. I love anything where you're kind of like buying shares and, you know, manipulating the value of things and everything. So I like that. And then Eric also showed me and a lot of people this new card game called Mind Up, which is like it has some DNA of Six Nymph. I don't know how to pronounce it. But all I know. All I know is it's a fun game. And that's like I taught my mom on BGA during the pandemic lockdown. I got her set up with BGA so we could like play some games on there, and she really enjoyed it. I think I don't remember if I ended up giving her my copy of it or something, but I think she's really gonna like Mind Up because it kind of takes some of that and makes it a little more interesting in my opinion. And then I also played all of the different games that are Spiel des Jahres nominees. Or at least the ones that I hadn't played before. So that was cool because we're going to be recording a game night episode where we'll kind of like give our thoughts on those games. Eric Lang was there. Got to hang with Eric and play some games with him.
He mentioned.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun. We had a good time. And then I also ate lots of barbecue, as one does in Texas.
As you gotta. I mean, come on. You're in Texas. What do you like? It's wrong if you didn't, unless you're a vegetarian or vegan.
We actually ended up at Heart Eight with a vegetarian. And he was like really excited because he was able to find enough non-meat options to eat there. So that's good.
I mean, you gotta love yourself some cornbread and stuff like that. Like, you can't go wrong.
And then the other highlight of BGG Spring for me was I'm losing track of time. In late April, I played a game of Dual Gauge, my first game of Dual Gauge, with Jonathan Cox from John Gick's Games. He coordinated a game online with some people, and two of those guys, I think, from that game. Yeah, it was two of them from that game. Taylor and Jake were there, and I got to meet them in person, and we played a bunch of games together, we have very similar tastes, and they love like trick-taking games and other kind of like market manipulation games that I love. So yeah, so that was really cool to like meet them and hang out with them. And, you know, it's always like fun to make new friends, new game friends. And yeah, so BGG Spring was cool. But anyways, I think people I know, and, you know, both of us who are like passionate about playing board games and or designing board games are equally passionate about like introducing board games to friends and families and just new people. You know, it's like we really want to grow this hobby. And it's like we're all so excited about this thing that brings us so much joy that we really want to just share that joy with others. So today we're going to discuss games we think are great for introducing people to the hobby.
All right. Yeah. So I think we're going to preface this to kind of frame who are these people? Many of you have probably seen or read articles previously of those classics, "Don't invite me to your game night" articles that usually boil down to someone reluctantly goes to a games night, gets something thrown that is way too heavy in front of them that lasts for probably at least an hour or more too long, and then they make an article about it. And it never makes the hobby look good. We look like, I don't know what we look like. We look like weirdos who don't know how to socially acclimate people towards gaming. And to be honest, that might be true a little bit because yeah, we're so excited about those games that we love, we forgot the route that it took us to get to those games in the first place. We didn't start there. Almost nobody starts there. And I think we forget that in our excitement and enthusiasm that we want them just to enjoy what we enjoy. But to be honest, they can't because they haven't had the experience, the framework. They don't even understand the base mechanics in order to, you know, maybe appreciate the game that you put in front of them. So let's preface here that it's really, really important when we're considering like introducing people to the hobby that there's a chance they maybe have never played anything plus what we might call classic games, right? So maybe they've played, you know, they've got their Monopolies and their Sorries and things like that. Maybe they've gone a tiny bit farther, but odds are they've only got the classics. So maybe the most recent thing they ever bought was like Cards Against Humanity. And we're still talking decades at this point, right, guys? So you just have to think about who that person is that maybe they're willing and excited to want to, you know, learn more about, hey, there's other things you can do with dice, cards, boards, and et cetera. But you've got to think about how to onboard them.
Yes. Very
right?
important.
That's the big one.
Very important.
So I would say the first thing is if you're going to look for things that have a sense of familiarity or some kind of recognition, if you can relate it to a game they already get, you're halfway there, right? I mean, it's how we do it in quick shorthand all the time. But we know when we're saying, hey, it's this game meets this game, you know, but it's got some sort of engine building element. We know what we're talking about. That just shortcutted to I know what that game was in 30 seconds. To a newbie, you just said nonsense.
Wonk,
right?
wonk, wonk.
Yeah. So try to frame it in the what's the classic thing or what's the really common, you know, card-based, game-based, whatever thing you can attach it to
as much as
possible. Yeah. And, you know, maybe it's always best to assume this is the first time that person has ever experienced that mechanic or maybe that layering of mechanics. Mm. Right. So just assume that you're going to have to introduce what that means to start with. You can't say drafting. That's meaningless. Right. What is drafting? You're going to have to break things down on that level. Right. So treat it like until they tell you otherwise, they have no idea what you're talking about. Because if you use lingo, like we said, like drafting, that unless I know what a drafting game is, what did you just say to me? Right? That didn't shortcut anything. That just confused me more. Now, if you told me I was going to keep cards out of a hand or I was going to take cards off the table
that
from this lovely spread that we see here, I didn't have to say drafting. You're on board with what I'm doing, though. Keep the experience manageable. So I think you'll notice really quickly, almost every game we picked is under 60 minutes for the most part.
Very important.
That is very intentional. You got to work your endurance up. You don't start in 2 hours.
Don't start them with Twilight Imperium.
You got to get there.
Don't start them with Twilight Imperium.
Oh, please don't. We want them to come back, guys. So you have to think about, and Twilight Imperium is a great one. Let's say I want to get someone to Twilight Imperium. What you honestly need to think about is, what are the fundamental mechanics of that game and what games introduce those? Let's give those building blocks to get there. So, and I want you to think about this, like in a general nutshell, if something is like top 100 on BGG, I mean, except for the rare exception, do not introduce that game to a hobby player. But you know what? Those might be your favorite games on that top 100. So what I'm saying is, break those games down to their core mechanics. Find a game that does that really cleanly and build that player up to that game.
Yeah.
Right? Let's get them onboarded so they're like, oh, I got this. Twilight Imperium is like, this game meets this game meets this game. Let's go. Because you introduced me to all those games first.
This is a whole nother future episode where it's like, how do you get somebody to Twilight Imperium? What are the building blocks? It's like, you know,
it's not 7 degrees. It's not like the 6 degrees of separation or like the 6 degrees from Kevin Bacon. It's what are the 6 games that get you to Twilight Imperium?
And who can, look, let's gamify it. Who can figure out what those games are and come up with a list and the order of those games and have the smallest amount of games?
Oh, it's a whole thing. You can absolutely gamify this, but if you take anything away and you want that new player to come to your table and come back to your table, really think about, how do I introduce a mechanic cleanly so now I could get them to another game next time?
Yep.
Right. Yeah. And so we'll kind of leave it at that, just sure, to frame, sure, you know, where we're going.
But before we start getting into the games that we would recommend for introducing people to the hobby, I'd love to hear what you've been playing lately, Erica. So let's jump into Fresh Plays.
I wanted to put 2 new-to-me games that I only played within the last couple months because there's something about them that really stood out. So April is a month where I speed play games, I'll be honest. Like, I speed play like everything I can get my hands on. It's just an opportunity thing based on, like, where I can be at the time for conventions. I don't get to 10 play cons quite as often because, unfortunately, work. You know, I'd love to, but they're not going to pay for me to go. So it's a little bit problematic. But I'll say there are 2 games that really stood out to me because they did something different and made me come back. There are a ton of games I play and I'm one and done. Just, you know what? I liked it, but, you know, whatever. I'm not doing it again. So the first one on my list, and this one surprised me because I'm actually not the biggest two-player game fan, was Sky Team. So Sky Team is actually a game, I think it's just about to come out. It may not officially be out yet, but it is coming out this year from my understanding. It is a game that Scorpion Mask is bringing out. So they'll be through Hachette Board Gaming, which we know has been kind of crushing it recently. So what this is, and maybe why it really got me, is this is one of the most genuine co-op two-player games I think I've ever seen. So if you've ever played a two-player game, there's a really good chance the other person could be an AI and there really wouldn't be that big a difference in the play. So for me personally, most two-player games are apps. I'd rather just play them that way because, honestly, what's the difference? This game, you cannot do that with. You cannot do that with this game. And that's what genuinely made me play it more than once. So let me just kind of explain a little bit what we're doing in this game. We are going to be co-pilots who are trying to land a plane together. All right. Each turn, we can do a quick plan before we start. But the minute our dice are rolled, and our dice are going to be how we basically, you know, control the plane. The minute the dice are rolled, we can't say a word to each other. We can only basically communicate by our dice placement. Okay. Now, what's really neat about this is there is 2 must-do things every turn. And then there are about four or five things that have to happen before the end of the game, or you're not landing or you're gonna crash and hit someone. So in classic co-op fashion, you know, especially like a good hobby level co-op fashion, you're not likely going to beat your first play, right? Like, so let's just put that out there. That is a very big difference between, again, if we're talking about that onboarding co-op game and that not so onboarding co-op game. If there is a genuinely good chance you're going to lose that first game, which, let's be honest, a lot of really good hobby co-ops are.
You want that challenge.
You
want to
jump back in there. But we've got that stamina, right? We want the challenge of, oh, I'm going to get this and I'm going to rock this game the next time.
Yeah.
You know, just again, I'll put a caveat. This is not one of those games I'd introduce a newbie to, right? Anyway, so the things we must do is each time both pilot and co-pilot must spend a dice that dictates the speed of the plane. And they must spend a dice that levels the plane in some way. And this could actually have you tilt. And so you actually can have a tilt that goes back and forth, but you can't over tilt. You basically crash. And you must right your plane. Your plane must be perfectly level by the time you land. So you're going to have a bit of this like tilts and thing going on. Now, all your other dice can be used to open the flaps of the plane, lower the landing gear, radio other planes to get out of the way so you don't crash into them. And there's a whole whack of them that need to be told to move. You're going to increase your brake speed. So your brake speed is so minor to begin with. You want a really nice range. You're going to have to unlock that as you go, or it's going to be almost impossible to stop. You also have to kind of maintain your distance. Not only are you going towards other planes, you're going down. And the last thing you could do is get coffee, because sometimes you just need a modifier. And so coffee literally gets you a little coffee token. This is something that it's a neat way to communicate with the other player is if I dedicate a dice to coffee, that now gave a plus or minus one to any dice at any time someone puts that coffee on it. So I could use that as a way of saying like, hey, my dice suck. Let's get modifiers, right? Or, you know, maybe I have a last dice. Let's throw the last dice there so we set up for the next turn. And I can kind of talk through my dice. So ultimately, we need to land the plane, make sure we don't hit anything on the way down, open the flaps, get your brakes ready, and land that sucker. And I think I played this game like at least 3, maybe 4 times because I was taught it. I played once because I wanted to introduce it to someone, and then I was asked to play a couple more times. And I never said no.
Awesome.
Right? Because there's something so well-tuned about this game. And as I said, that other person matters as much as you do.
That's so cool. Someone else told me about Sky Team. I don't remember who, but I think it might be coming out at Gen Con or It's soon.
It's soon. I would say it's a checkout game for sure. If anything I said sounded good to you, unless you hate co-ops, in which case ignore what I said.
Yeah. Also, a game that's designed for two players as a co-op. You know, like any co-op game, you can play with two players. Sure, you can play them solo, but that's kind of cool that it's designed for two players. And I love games that have that whole element of like we can't talk to each other. Like,
limited communication.
Yeah, very limited interesting. Communication games. But yeah, this sounds really cool. I'm definitely probably going to pick this up. You like how I said definitely probably?
I would definitely buy this.
I'm going to get it.
This would go on my shelf.
Okay, I'm going to get it. I'm sold. So I recently played a game that is not new at all. It is an older game called Big Shot. And Big Shot is something that I had been kind of like wanting to check out for a while. I think a couple of years ago, I saw like a video on YouTube and I was kind of intrigued. Maybe it was like a heavy cardboard video. But it's been out of print, so I just have never been able to play it. Then at BGG Spring, my friend Taylor happened to mention that he had the new version of it. And I didn't even know there was a new version of it. So I was like, how do I get this? And he pretty much hit me to a shop in Austin that had it. And they have a bunch of other really good imports. So I placed a little order, got a couple games. And, you know, so I played it at BGG Spring. And then I've played it 2 more times since just because it's very quick, easy to teach, like great little filler for end of the night when you're like, oh, don't quite want to go home, but don't want to play something that's too long. So this was...
Yeah, what's that 20, 30 minute
So this is... it was originally released in 2001 from Ravensburger, but the new 2022 edition is from a South Korean publisher, Plate, P-L-A-Y-T-E. And I, as a side, I happened to check out their website and I noticed they also make this game called Moonleap, which I was like, that sounds familiar. And it's and then I checked my podcast notes and Stephen Bonacore had talked about it on episode 16. So I was like, oh, this is the same company. Made that little connection.
I think I wanted to check that out at somewhere and I couldn't find it. That sounds so
familiar. Yeah, I think you... I don't know how to get it yet, but it sounded really cool.
The Korean games are hard to get, guys. You have no idea. Like, I am so thankful I got my Pokemon Point Salad. Do you know how hard it was to get games out of Korea?
Yeah. No, I feel you. So I'm going to look at shops like the one in Austin. It was called, I don't know if I mentioned it or not, but Tanuki, I think. Tanuki Games. But like, I wonder if they have that one.
I was going to say, guys, if you ever find places that are really good for importing, not only, you know, make sure you hit them up yourself, but let other people know.
Tell me.
Because there's not that many places that honestly have that relationship. It's not as easy as, hey, I'm just going to put in an order. You kind of need to know who to order from. And so getting stuff out of Korea, it's like if you know something, like let us know. Like, you know what I mean?
Please.
Let us know where you're getting it.
Please, yeah.
Yes.
But they also had another game that kind of caught my attention. It was a dexterity game called Tasso Banana, where you're like, you have to quickly stack these little banana tokens on a banana tree. Anyways, so back to Big Shot. This is a game designed by Alex Randolph, who also designed Ricochet Robots, which I actually played for the first time a couple months ago with Tom and some of the people from Game Brain. But Big Shot is an auction area majority game for 2 to 4 players. And the theme is very loose, but there's basically a building boom and we're all rushing to kind of take ownership of valuable properties without falling too deeply into debt. And debt is a serious thing in this game. The goal of the game is to have the most money after we do 18 auctions. And the game comes in a small box, which is another plus for me because it doesn't take up that much shelf space, easy to travel with. And inside it, you'll have like a small game board and then a bunch of wooden cubes in 4 different colors, red, blue, yellow, brown. Then you're going to like take all the cubes and randomly distribute them into the 18 auction spaces on the left and right side of the board so that each space has 4 cubes. And there has to be at least 2 different colors in each space. And then on your turn, like whoever's the start player, you're going to roll a die. And I also should mention there's a little broker meeple kind of guy that like a pawn that you randomly place on one of those spaces. So on your turn, you roll this die and then you're going to move that broker to, you know, that many steps away and you're going to have an auction for those 4 cubes at that space. And it's just a regular old auction, highest bidder wins. But everybody starts the game with $10 million. We'll just say 10 bucks. And after that, like you never get income in this game, but you can take a loan. You can take 1 loan per round. And the thing about the loans are they're minus $10 each at the end of the game. But the first loan you take gives you $9 because of interest. The second loan you take only gives you $8 because more interest. Then the third loan you take gives you $7 and so on and so forth. So, but you're always losing 10 points per loan that you take.
This sounds very stressful.
So then like basically when if you're the one that wins the auction, you get to place these cubes out on the board into these different areas however you'd like. So you could put all 4 into one space. You could put all 4 into 4 different spaces, whatever you like. And basically the way the board is, there are different areas that have some amount of points or, you know, a dollar value because money is points in this game. But so you'll put these cubes out and then you'll next person will roll the die, then they'll auction off and you keep doing this until 18 auctions are done. And then you will see who has the most money. But there are a couple twists to the game besides the loan system. The way the area majority scoring works is the minute that a space, an area, has 7 cubes, it scores. Whoever has the majority of cubes of their color wins the property. And you put this little sold sign and you leave your cube there to say you own that. You get those points at the end of the game, or that value of money. But when you're scoring area majority, any cubes that are tied cancel each other out. So what that means is, if there are 2 red cubes, 2 yellow cubes, and 2 brown cubes, and the 7th cube is the blue cube, guess what? That's going to score, and the blue player is going to win it because all the other cubes canceled each other out because they all had 2. So there are some really, really interesting decisions that come with placing these cubes, knowing how that works. The other cool thing is, most of the spaces just have a value that you'll get in money at the end of the game. But there are 2 spaces that are doubler spots, times 2. So if you are able to take control of a times 2 space, and you also have control of a space that is adjacent to that times 2, you're going to double the value of that when you score at the end of the game. But anyways, this game is just so like simple, easy to learn, quick to play. If you like auction games, if you like area majority scoring games, this is a no-brainer. I accidentally messed up one of the rules because this was taught to me, and I guess I just didn't even really take this into consideration. I didn't realize that you could only take 1 loan per round. So the 2 games that I played on my own where I taught it, there were some rounds where people, I think there was at least 1 or 2 times where somebody took 3 loans and 1 thing, because we were just like bidding it up, you know. And it's one of those games, like kind of like QE or something, where, you know, the first set of cubes might go for like $3. But then, like, by the end of the game, it's like $17. No, you know, of course.
Especially if you're taking 3 loans.
And that is with my signature multi-loan variant. Don't do that. Don't play that way.
You made it Billionaire's Edition. That's what you did.
Yeah. And it's also like, it was kind of like reminiscent of Rumble Nation a little bit in its simplicity and area majority scoring. But I liked that a lot. What else have you been playing, Erica?
So a fun one that really stood out for me, because it's such a classic, but got a new twist. And I was like, oh, is this going to be a stupid gimmicky twist? Or like, oh no, I actually kind of like this twist. was Miss Over Carcassonne.
Oh!
So I don't know if it's officially out in English, because I think I had to play a German version. Because it's Hans im Glück. But I think it's coming out with Z-Man, which will be the English one. So, I mean, in my head, Carcassonne is always that passive aggressive, area control game, right? Where you're kind of being nasty as indirectly as possible, but you're kind of being nasty to each other, yeah. Right? Like, there's no part of that where you're always just thinking about how can I get something away from somebody else. Imagine flipping your thinking completely, having the same tile placement, but now you're doing it together for a common goal. You're like,
Very interesting.
You made me go after all of this against somebody, and now we're doing it together? We can build a castle together? Like, you're like, that's crazy. But it works. Like, you wouldn't think of something being competitive on that level, just being like, hey, we're making it a co-op. You're like, yeah, right. You're like, okay, I get this. So what happens is that, imagine regular Carcassonne, you can still complete cities. Sorry, I call them castles. I know they're cities. You can complete cities, you can complete roads. There are no farmers because something else has mechanically taken over. There are ghosts. Now, in this game, one of the types of areas that can grow is called mist. In the mist is ghosts. So like a regular Carcassonne game, you do not want to cut off this tile. You want to complete sections, just like any of the other mechanics. So it's already using what you know, but in a slightly new way. Every time you add mist, you're going to have to add ghosts to the board. Mm. Now, you only have so many ghosts you're allowed to the board, add to the board. If you cannot add them, you lost. Oh. And I will just preface right now, this game is hard. It will take you several attempts because I think there's like, the best way to put it is like there's six levels or something like that to this game. Each time you beat one, it'll introduce you to a new tile or mechanic, or it'll adjust scoring to make it harder. So you kind of go in, you learn it a little bit, you learn how ghosts work. So for example, the ghosts go out. Each time you add to existing mist, you have the number of ghosts that go out. So you kind of want to build up on mist. If you can close mist off, all the ghosts go away in that mist. But one more neat thing that can happen is you can turn your score into removing ghosts instead. So let's say, you know, the classic thing to get quick points in Carcassonne was what we like to call the football cities, right? Where it's just the two pieces put together. Doing something like that isn't worth a lot of points, but doing that could actually be traded. So rather than taking the points, you can remove all ghosts from a single tile.
Oh.
If let's say you have a really short road, instead of taking the points for the road, you can move all the ghosts from a single tile. So now it's this question of, well, the game, the ending of the game is don't get rid of all, like make sure that you haven't gotten rid of all the ghosts and get to a certain point.
Mm.
So you're exchanging points to get rid of ghosts. You can only maintain that so long. So you have to play this game of what's the biggest things we can make to get the biggest points while also maintaining these small things, because these ghosts are awful and going to take over incredibly fast.
Gotcha.
Then you beat that round. Yay! Guess what? We're adding a new tile. Now there's graveyards. Hey, you beat that round. Guess what? We're adding a new tile. Now there's castles. Hey, you beat that round. Guess what? Now it's even harder.
Wow. Sounds cool.
So it's oddly punishing. But in a way that doesn't make you mad, it makes you like, I'm gonna beat this
gotcha.
Thing. We're gonna get through this. Right. And so what's really cool about it is because it's effectively six levels, however you want to say it. I don't know. For some reason it's like almost video gamey to me. You could turn this almost into like a campaign with a regular gaming group. You know, it's like, you guys got past level one. Cool. Are you ready for level two? Are you ready for level three? Can we finally get enough points to beat level four, five, and six? There's something really neat about a game that can do that, let alone the fact that it already is based on an existing game with enough of a twist that you're like, interesting.
Wow. Sounds cool.
Right? But it kind of felt like it rejuvenated Carcassonne, because I feel like that's a classic. Again, you know, we were talking about introducing people to new games. Carcassonne is a great one to get into as an early Euro. But again, please don't start people on Euros.
Ease them in.
But it's got, you know, there's something about farmers that does not click with people the first time you teach Carcassonne. But overall, as a tile placement game, it is a nice introduction to tile placement, worker placement. But if you notice, I just said two mechanics, which also means that there's a good chance it is not a good starter game for this group we were talking about.
Especially if you say it like that by naming the mechanics. See,
yeah,
I'm learning.
So I just named two mechanics. Probably. See, that's going to be like day two stuff right there.
So that's Mist over Carcassonne. Yeah, I have very little experience with Carcassonne. This was a game that I think I bought at some point early on, but I also bought the app, and I would mostly play the app. And I honestly don't know if I've ever played the actual physical board game. I don't think I ever did.
It's fair. I play it digitally a lot personally, too. I have the app as well. Board Game Arena is great because it has all the expansions.
Cool.
So if you ever want to jump into that, I will just say, people on Board Game Arena, like, Carcassonne is a pretty aggressive game when you really think about it. So just know, if you're going to play against people on Board Game Arena, you'd expect it. Expect
cool.
it.
Cool. Mist over Carcassonne. So
yeah, co-op Carcassonne.
I love co-op, so that's cool. And it kind of, I don't know if you got a chance to play yet, Dorf Romantic, the board game. That is
No, I wanted it to. It was on my list for Essen, and I didn't get a copy, so I haven't.
Yeah,
played it
I want to. I'm curious to see how that compares to this. You know, as a cooperative tile laying game, that's cool. Before I jump to my second fresh play game, I just want to give a quick shout out to a game I was introduced to at BGG Spring. So another person I played a bunch of games with is my friend Derek. Derek, I think I met last year at BGGCon. A lot of these guys I'm mentioning, I know through the Portland Games Collective, and they're big into trick-taking games, and they're always like hipping me to like whatever the hot new imports are to check out and everything. But we played a game called Le Plateau, and it's a trick-taking game where you each round will be bidding to do kind of like this abstract strategy game. So I think you could either get this, make this game as a print and play, and then the cards you use is a French tarot deck. So it had, okay. Yeah, it was the deck we played with was like super beautiful, but it had like a C, which I think was a knight, and then a jack, queen, and king also.
It didn't have R for king?
No, it didn't have an R.
Then that's not actually French.
Okay, I don't know. It, you know,
I live. Okay. So anyone who doesn't know, I'm Canadian, you know, so we get force fed French from the start. So but if you ever see a French deck, it's like, king is like, it's almost like the word royal to a degree. And so if you ever see a deck of cards, the king is an R.
So that's interesting because like when that. I went to then, buy this game, I bought, there was like a wooden version that we played. I think it was Brown Castle Games has it. But when I went to buy it, they give you the option of like, I think there was a version where they had like R, Q, J or whatever, but there was also one with the C, J, Q, K. Anyways, like,
because, you know, the words start with different letters in other languages. So it's one of those fun things if you ever get a chance to pick up a French deck of cards.
Yeah, and this is like French tarot. I am not an expert at this deck of cards by any means or this game. But what I thought was like really interesting is that it's a trick-taking game that is also like hybrid with an abstract strategy game where you will also be on a temporary alliance with other players. So like basically there's like a whole there's a bidding phase where you're bidding on the type of like abstract strategy victory you're going for. Like one is just making a bridge from one side of the board to the other. Another is like something like different sections, like you're trying to connect to different sections of the board. I think there are like about five different ones and they're like kind of different levels that you can kind of bid that you're going to get, but then you're going to call out a card and whoever has that card is going to be on your team for the round. And it's like, then it becomes like this abstract strategy game of playing these tricks. And when you win a trick, you get to put these tokens out on certain spaces of the board. Like every card doesn't have a space. I'm probably like butchering this because I need to play this game more, but I was super intrigued by it. I had to buy it. And, Derek helped me by ordering me a French tarot deck so I can, you know, get all the pieces together. So anyways, thank you for introducing me to that game, Derek. And Jake and Taylor.
I always love the idea. I love the idea of games that use existing things. Like you forget how many games you first learn, you know, with a simple deck of cards, right? And then the idea of like all of these different games people come up with, these base decks.
Right.
And so I think that's got like that, almost that nice tradition, you know, kind of baked into it.
And then
it.
You think of like abstract strategy games like chess or something. And now it's like, oh, I'm going to mix like trick taking with chess or something, you know, like, or something that feels that way. Anyway, super, super neat, Le Plateau. But the second game that I wanted to mention is a new game. It is a game from WizKids called Rebuilding Seattle. And I think it just came out like this year, like maybe a couple months ago, 2023. It's designed by Quinn Brander. And it's a city building game for 1 to 5 players that basically takes place after the Great Fire of 1889. burned down like most of downtown Seattle, and each player, we're basically city planners and we're trying to rebuild Seattle. And so first off, thanks to Quinn and WizKids for sending me a copy of the game so I could check it out. But basically each player is going to have their own district player board, and all the player boards are unique. So they have some asymmetry to them, which is cool. And then you also each get your own like starting neighborhood, which is kind of a tile that has some pre-printed buildings on them. And those are all different. So everybody kind of has an asymmetric start, and you're competing to gain the most victory points from building up your neighborhood over the course of three rounds. There are a lot of different, well, a few different ways you could score points, but one of the main ways is by increasing the quality and the amenity levels of your entertainment, shopping, and restaurant buildings. So on your player board, you have three different quality tracks, one for each of those entertainment, shopping, and restaurants. And then you also have one track that it almost looks like a small victory point track on your player board, where you're going to be tracking the amenity level of these different types of buildings. And there are other types of buildings in this game too, but you're mainly tracking those in relation to your population, which is also tracked on the same track as the amenity. But it sounds kind of like complex, but the gameplay is like really, really straightforward. Like you basically, like on your turn, there are four phases to each round, but the main like meat and potatoes happens in the build phase. And that's where players are going to alternate taking turns. And on your turn, you have like one of three things you could do. You can buy a suburb tile, and or you could buy a building tile for your neighborhood. You can activate an event, or you can enact a law. And so the first one is that's like how you're going to be actually doing your city building. Suburb tiles are kind of mostly blank tiles that are going to expand your neighborhood so that you have spaces to actually put buildings. And the buildings are polyomino tiles, so Tetris pieces. And each type of building has like a different color, and it has a different icon also. They're different shapes, they're different sizes. And to build a building, there's a card market row, and you have like all these different building cards out. And each round, there's a different deck of cards that you'll play with. And the cost kind of depends on where they are in the card row. So maybe I spend $4, I get a card that lets me build a shopping building. You know, when I build that shopping building, depending on the size of the tile and how many icons, shopping icons are on there, that's how I increase my amenity level for that type of building. But each card, each building card also has like this upgrade on the bottom of it, which is cool. So the upgrade is either going to allow you to increase your quality level of one of those three categories, or it's going to give you some kind of like engine building profit generator, because there's a profit phase in this game where you get money, and you will need to get money because money is pretty tight in this game. The other thing you can do on your turn is you can enact a law. And laws are, you have, I think, like three different law options on your player board. And this is where some of the asymmetry comes in, because each person's laws are different. And for example, like one of the districts I was playing as, I had a law where I could get $8, but I had to also increase my population by one. And population in this game, you do not want to increase. You want to keep it as low as possible, as close to your amenity levels as possible, hopefully lower than your amenity levels, for reasons, mainly because you have these event cards you can trigger. That's the other thing you could do on your turn. You can trigger an event, and these events are really like, they add a lot of like spice to what would be otherwise kind of like a, you know, straightforward city building game where you're putting polyominoes out, you know. But these event cards, like there are three of them that kind of function the same, that relate to those tracks I was talking about, restaurant, shopping, and entertainment. And basically when you trigger one of those, whoever triggers an event is going to get some bonus, and then all players get to do something. So like when you trigger one of those particular events, you're going to look at where your quality level is for the corresponding event type. So if we're doing entertainment, we're going to look on your blue track, see what your quality level is, and that's going to tell you your base value for your reward. Now, if that particular marker on your amenity track is below your population, you decrease whatever reward you get for the amount of spaces below your population it is. So, for example, I know that was a mouthful, but if you were going to get like a reward of $10 and your population is 4 higher than your blue track, then you lose $4 off that. You would only get $6. But if your amenity level is above or at your population, then you get the whole $10. So you're constantly trying to balance decreasing your population, increasing these amenity levels by building more of these different types of buildings. But you also, again, money is super tight in the game. So you can't just always be building. You need to figure out ways to generate income. One of the ways you do that is there are other events. Like there's an event that's basically, it's called Activate Nature's Impact. And when you get those suburb tiles, one of the things I didn't mention, they're mostly blank, but they'll have little symbols on them. And there's a lot of, there's so many of these suburb tiles you can get. And the distribution of these nature symbols are kind of vary from tile to tile. But when you trigger this event, like in round one, any tree icon that you have that's visible on your board, you get a buck for each. In like in the last round, for every tree, you get a buck, and every mountain, you get a point. So like you're trying to, as you're building your city, not cover up those icons as much as possible so that whoever, whenever this event gets triggered, you can like kind of get some good rewards. There's another one that lets you get suburb tiles for cheap. And it's really interesting to see how this game plays out, because on your turn, again, you're either going to build, or you could trigger one of these events, or you can do a law. And you're constantly kind of like, I found myself like watching my opponent. I've only played this two players so far, but I'm watching my opponent like, oh no, is he going to trigger this? Please don't trigger it right now. Like I need to set myself up, but oh no, he triggered it. You know, like, and when all six events are triggered, that ends that particular phase. And that's like, again, like the big player action phase. And then the other thing is there are also landmark cards, which are like special tiles. So at the beginning of the game, everybody gets 3 of these landmark cards and you get to keep 2. So you have throughout the game, these 2 special tiles only you can build into your city or your neighborhood. And they're expensive, like $15, $16, but a lot of them will give you some kind of endgame scoring condition. So that kind of gives you something to work towards. So anyway, this game is pretty cool. I'm always kind of trying to figure out like what are some of my favorite city building games. And, you know, I definitely enjoy that mechanism of like starting something small and, you know, customizing it and looking at it at the end of the game. But this game I found really interesting because you have to balance like a lot of different things that all work together. Like you're trying to reduce your population, you're trying to increase your amenity levels and your quality levels, and you really can't do it all. Like there are 3 different, you know, things you're trying to push on 2 different tracks, and it's hard to do it all. So trying to like figure out what to do when is like kind of crucial, and you're just trying to set yourself up so that either you can trigger certain events at optimal times and maybe try to, you know, pull the trigger on them before they're not, while it's not optimal for your opponents. And then again, there's also just like the spatial puzzle of you're building a city out there, and like you're trying not to cover up these symbols for those like that nature event. And you're also just managing your money because money is so tight in this game. So I have a friend, my friend Ben loves city building games. So I'm very curious to like see what he thinks of this one. And but so far I'm really enjoying it. And again, it's like very simple, but like feels a little different like because of this, these events that you're triggering while as you're building your city. So that is Rebuilding Seattle. Have you heard of that or played it, Erica?
I know I haven't. I mean, I think it's a good premise because think about like, you know, that whole polyomino phase, like fad that kind of started from, I want to say, Patchwork. And then you've got like the Isle of Cats. And then it like, you know, there was a kind of a good span of them that kept going for a little while. To keep a mechanic looking fresh, you need that layering that eventually happens. And so this sounds like it's got, you know, those layers of flavor that give it that something a little different. Because, you know, as you said, there are city building tiling games already, right? What makes this different? You can hear how much stress there is on the different balances you have to maintain. But for some people, that is a rush, especially if it's in a, you know, in a very finite amount of turns or time.
Yeah. And like I said, I've only played it with two so far. And it was great with two. Like I'm almost like one of the things when you increase the player count, I think it goes to five players. But one of the things that happens is you add like board extenders. So more cards are available to buy, which I think that will be an interesting dynamic because it's like there was like one round where we had in one of my games, like we had a bunch of like pink building cards. And I was like, oh, well, that's not great. You know, we're looking for other stuff. But if you're playing a higher player count game, you're going to have a wider spread of cards. Yeah. So anyway, that's Rebuilding Seattle. I'm looking forward to playing it more. So shall we talk about some great games for introducing people to the hobby?
Yes, let's say we've invited brand new people over. You know, let's not assume they know anything about what we're talking about. We want them to feel included. We want them to learn a mechanic that they feel comfortable with. Because we want them to come back.
Yes, yes. Let's grow this thing. On my list of games that I picked, I did not include any party games. I think party games are like totally great games for getting people into the hobby. But I was just trying to focus on non-party games that can kind of hook people in. And I also just wanted to give a shout out to Ticket to Ride because I think that's an excellent game for introducing people to the hobby. But personally, I just rarely use that one. I rarely break it out, so I didn't include it, but I think it's an awesome game to get people into the hobby, and it's gotten lots of people into the hobby, you know?
I think that's totally fair. That's a great onboarding one because the card mechanic, when you're talking about familiarity, that card mechanic is so simple. It's so, you're already used to it in so many, you know, very straightforward deck card games. The only thing you're really learning essentially is path building.
Yep.
Right. And so the nice thing is it's got that something that's recognizable. So, and I think that's kind of what we're looking at a lot. I didn't really put party games. I definitely have filler games because I think that's oftentimes a really good way to keep someone playing.
Something quick that they could just jump back into and like, oh, I like that. Let's play it again. Doesn't take too much time. Yeah. So what's on your list?
So my first one is not as quick. But what's really nice about this game is it is a co-op game. It's a new one that's actually just come out this year called Kazooka, because you're in the zoo. And this is going to be a game where we all work together because we're actually animals trying to escape the zoo. We are going to be doing this by using our cards, these object cards, which are all these things, garbage, you know, stuff that the humans have left behind. Our goal is to escape. Now, what's really interesting about this game is that it's going to introduce players to a few different things. First off, the characters have a really, really light asymmetry. Now, this might seem like it's something that's a little bit, you know, maybe bigger to introduce someone to. But what's really nice about this is if you've already played the game before, and a lot of these games, I will just preface, you probably want to have played before so that you can help the player through.
Yes, yes.
So if you played something like this game before, you can pick the abilities that are going to be super helpful to those newbie players, right? That give them a really nice advantage. They're all going to be good in some way, but you know which ones are already going to be more intuitive, a little easier to use. So I would already say you can give those to them. What's neat about this game is fundamentally all you're really doing is trying to guess how many of a certain color of card you think the whole table has. But this game, you cannot talk to each other. We're animals.
More limited communication.
All you know is what... More limited communication. It. But it's what's nice about that game, too, when you have limited communication with a new player, it's also going to diminish quarterbacking. So you can talk about things between, but you can't have someone leading in this game because your turn effectively is this. You take a look at your cards. You know what colors you've got. You're going to have this really nice track that's going, it's a little busy for my taste. I'll just as a heads up, but it has this really nice winding track down the middle. What you're really doing is you're moving your little like wooden tokens onto the number that is effectively your bid. So if I move my little guy onto a blue five, all I'm saying to the table is, I think amongst all of us, there's five blues. Like, what a very simple premise, right? But we're doing this obviously without talking. As it gets to each person's turn, they have basically a choice. Do I call it and say, yes, I think we've got this and we want to bank what we've managed? Or do I push it? Because we really do want to get to the end of that track. Now, you're never going to get to the end of the track the first few rounds you play because you got to kind of get used to it. That's what this game does well. It doesn't just say, and you're done, right? What it is that it kind of introduces you how to play through that first round. You're maybe going to get three quarters halfway through the zoo, but you unlock something. Oh, what did you unlock? Oh, we've unlocked having like, you know, going a little further, having more cards, getting little tools. Now, this sounds like a lot, but all it means is, oh, we now have a wild card in the deck or we now have this in the deck. And so it's these really nice introduction to these base mechanics that you see in everything. But it's that, you know, it's not the heavy version of any of this. So it's going to introduce asymmetry, but it's little, right? It's going to introduce, you know, this idea of blind betting, but that's not a foreign concept to people. That's kind of a push your luck gambling moment, right? It's just, you know, now balancing more, how do I kind of work with the whole table? And since that's the only thing you're really worried about, I feel like that makes it a really nice onboarding game for somebody because you can facilitate a lot of that play, but there's not a lot of pressure either because you're like, oh no, I thought we had six greens. Oh, we didn't. Next round. Like, you know, you're not going to feel like you failed something. Right. And so the nice thing about this game is because we're all in it together. The nice thing about co-ops, and I'm sure this is going to come up a bunch in our list in general, you know, there isn't really a winner or a loser. Right. What's nice about that is we did it together. So if we lost together, it's an experience. If we won together, it's an experience. Right. You'll end up winning this one, you know, just because of just the order of playing, you know, enough rounds, you'll end up unlocking what you need to unlock and you get to the end and yay, you've escaped the zoo. But you did a really cool thing where you kind of figured out some really, you know, we learned the players a little bit, learned your powers a little bit, you know, that kind of thing. And it's a nice game. That just came out this year from Pegasus Spiel. Again, I really hope it gets a bit of an artistic redesign, just for my personal opinion. But it's a nice co-op for what it's introducing that could seem complicated, but it's a bunch of little things that's just enough that if you want to teach them something bigger next time, there's a lot they just learned in this that shouldn't be overwhelming because we're doing it together.
Yeah, and I think also the theme of this one will be like appealing to like kind of hook people in like, oh, we're animals in a zoo.
We're animals in a zoo, right? It's, you know, because a lot of the times like, okay, so something similar to this, you know, not necessarily in play style, but in terms of like, you know, onboarding, it could have been, you know, let's say like a pandemic or something like that. The thing is that theme matters when you're onboarding somebody. If, as you said, there's something very accessible about this theme. Why? Because we're animals, so who cares? When it gets too real or too heavy or something or too dry, let's be honest, we can ignore, you know, the window dressing, but most people can't. And so just know that there are definitely great games out there that could be great to introduce, but you kind of maybe have to get them like, oh, yeah, I like co-ops. Now let's go
right,
do that
right,
one.
Right, right, right. Yeah, the Kazooka, Nikki actually had this on as one of her favorite co-op games when we did an episode together on the podcast. And someone else, you know, this is another one that is kind of on my list that I would really like to try because I do like these games with limited communication and I also like co-ops. And it just, yeah, every time I hear someone talk about it, I'm like, ooh, I really want to try that. I want to try that game.
Yeah, say good onboarding co-op, but I would say please make sure you've played it before you introduce it to others, because it'll just make such a smoother experience. And you can do those little staging moments where, you know, you're suggesting certain animals probably would be better for them to be based on the player ability.
And in general, I totally agree with that, you know, that I think with all of these games, you should really, you should have played them before and, you know, have some experience with it, because you're, that's totally going to kind of ease someone else in if they have someone where they can confidently ask you a question and you don't have to like flip through the rules, or, you know, you're not confused. Like knowing the game, knowing the game and is going to be really helpful for giving somebody a real smooth intro experience into modern board games. So first game on my list is, it's a game that I have probably introduced to a lot of friends who don't play board games. It's not a ton, but a few, and I've seen their reactions, and they get it and they enjoy it. And that game is Quacks of Quedlinburg, which is designed by Wolfgang Warsch, and it came out in 2018, published by Schmidt Spiele and North Star Games. And it's a 2-4 player game, but with the Herb Witches expansions, you can play with up to 5 players. And it's a push your luck and bag building game. So in the game, you're a quack doctor, and each player is going to have their own player board, which looks like a pot of like witch's brew kind of thing. And, you know, it's like it's actually like one of my favorite player boards. I think I love the way it looks. Like the art on it is just great. But in the pot, there's a track that's kind of like spiraling out from the center of the board. And you have this bag of these little ingredient tokens, and everybody starts their bag the exact same way with the variety of tokens. And you take a token out and you put it on your board. You count that many spaces away from the previous token that you placed. And you're trying to kind of push to see how far you can move up on this track with these ingredients without busting. The number on the ingredient token is basically how many spaces away you're going to place that ingredient from the previous one that you placed. And each player also has a certain amount of these cherry bomb ingredients. And if your potion ever has a total value of cherry bombs over 7, you bust. There's something you could do to kind of mitigate that. But the cool thing is that all these ingredients, they have their own little rules to them. And at the end of the round, you get the opportunity to buy new ingredients, which you'll add to your bag. So I think this is a great introduction game because it's light, it's colorful, it has a playful theme, and it's a game where you can teach. I mean, you were talking about teaching Kazooka and like gradually like learning more rules. This game, like, you start off very basic, and throughout the game, as you get deeper into your rounds, you're going to add other ingredients in. You don't need to explain how any of those ingredients work at the start of the game. You know, all you have to do is kind of give people the core idea. You can tell them when you're teaching it, hey, let's do this together, because this, I didn't mention this, but the gameplay is simultaneous. So you can really get someone up and running with this game like within 5 minutes, and you're playing your first round, and then you're just kind of like teaching the end of round steps as you go. And then, oh, new ingredients come later. I'm going to tell you about these ingredients now because you have a feel for how this other stuff works. So I think the simultaneous gameplay is fun. And like I said, you can do an interactive teach with that. And then it's just, you know, it's satisfying to kind of customize your bag. A lot of people find push your luck games exciting. And in this game, it's not very punishing when you do bust. It's more of like, ah, ha, ha, I still get to do something. But there's also a really good catch-up mechanism with like these rat tails. So like having a good catch-up mechanism, if somebody does fall behind, it's like, oh, well, now here you have this little boost to help you with next round. And again, it doesn't take that long to play. So for those reasons, I think Quacks of Klingberg is a good game to like get somebody into gaming and show them kind of like, hey, yeah, there are other stuff out there besides your, you know, your Monopolies and your Saris and Unos, the games you grew up with, like, you know.
And no, it makes sense because honestly, this is a, other than I think the only caveat with this game is scoring is a bit of a curve to explain to people, but to, in all honesty, if you, you know, if you've, again, if you've played it, you can easily help someone score up. And that's the only one I've ever seen people stumble on. Mm. What's really nice is this game is based on a very familiar thing you've been doing since pretty much grade one or two. And that is just like, I mean, basic probability, right? So what's super nice about a bag builder is not only is it really satisfying, but it is an inherent like just idea that people get. They get that there's so much of a thing in the bag. If I pull this, this is the odds of getting it. Like people inherently understand that type of gaming because they, you know, have been taught basic probability, you know, through most of school, that kind of thing. It's already playing off of something they are super familiar with and can run with. And that's why I say the only one on that one is the scoring gets like when you're first looking at these, like the little books in the middle, you're like, what does all this mean? Right. You know what? You get it once you've played it, but you're just going to have to ease somebody in on the scoring or just say, don't even worry about it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We're going to just play for fun. We're going to as far as we can. Don't worry about like that, that value, you know, increment going up and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So that is Quacks of Klingberg. What's your next game?
So I think a lot of us in hobby love dice games. The thing is, if you want to onboard someone for dice games, odds are the only thing they've probably played is Yahtzee.
Mm.
All right. We have to be very, very honest about this. What other dice games could they, in reality, what other dice games have they really played? Even classic games only really started getting dice-ified recently. The only other one I can think of as an exception is like Don't Farkle? Go to Jail Maybe by Monopoly Farkle? That came out in like the 80s. Maybe Farkle, if someone was willing to pick it off the shelf. Right? So I love dice in games, especially hobby games. And we know that the number of dice in games can get crazy. And what they can do is so vast. So many different things you can do with dice. Thing is, you got to get people ready for dice. One of my favorite games to get people ready for dice is Can't Stop.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the other thing I really like that's underlying this game is you're teaching people what a basic two dice spread looks like. And that might sound silly, but it's not something the average person has thought about. Mm. That's something gamers think about all the time. We're like, well, I know that, you know, 7, 8, you know, whatever you're going to say, like, you know, 7, 8, 9 are the most likely numbers to come up, you know, or 6, 7, 8, 9. So we understand inherently what the likelihood of certain combinations coming up are. And that understanding is what helps us go into all those other fun games where we're checking even more dice. You got to get them used to that idea that now there's an average. Right? Things get added together or they can take on more than one form. It might sound silly, but that is a huge step for most people. So in general, Can't Stop is probably, I would say most people might say it's a filler game, right? It can be a little longer than that, but it's probably a filler game. What's really nice about this is just a race to get three full rows. You may have seen this mostly abstractly done. Sometimes it may be like climbing a mountain or something. But what the board does is a perfect bell curve of a two dice distribution. It is 2 to 12. And it is based, the columns are based on the length of the likelihood of that number coming up. So you, all you're doing is pushing your luck. It feels like that nice gambling moment. So you're going to roll these four die. You're going to pair them up because they're creating quantities. And those quantities, again, can equal 2 to 12. And what you're doing is each time you're trying to push to climb those little columns as much as you can. But if you roll something that you can't place, you bust, which means you got none of that progress. And you're right back to where you started. So what's really nice about this game is that all the little things it teaches that will instantly let you get to another dice game now that they get that dice don't just have to be, oh, look, I made a pair. Oh, look, I made a run. Mm. Right. And that's how they think of dice right now. They almost think of it like poker. I want you to think of dice as something else. I'm going to introduce you to a nice dice game then.
Yeah.
Right? And so I think Can't Stop is a really great one for that, because you're onboarding them to potentially much bigger games if they get this basic idea.
My mom loves Can't Stop. This is another one that I introduced her to on BGA, and we played it a lot. Like, I think every other weekend or something, we would hop on BGA and play in a video chat and play that for a bit. And then I ended up getting her the actual board game, the physical board game, and she plays that a lot too.
It changes how you think about dice, mm-hmm. though. Dice can now be something new. But guess what? Now that you think dice are new, we can play all kinds of stuff, right?
Totally. My next game has no dice. And I'm sure you're going to think it's definitely a bit more challenging, but it is a game that I started playing early on into the hobby. And it's just a game that has stayed on my shelf, mainly because Matt, my partner Matt, loves it. And he would kill me if I ever got rid of it. But I also, it's fun. It's a fun game. And that is Citadels, designed by Bruno Fedutti. It was originally released back in 2000, but I have I'm not sure who the original publisher was, but I have the Z-Man Games edition of the newer, bigger box that's from 2016. This game can play with 2 to 8 players. It is a city tableau building game where each round each player is going to secretly select a roll card, and roll cards have different abilities, and that's going to be kind of your role for the round. And one of the roles is the king, and whoever was the king from the previous round is going to then call out one roll at a time. And when your roll is called, you get to take your turn. And basically, the spread of I think there are 8 different characters. So like in a 4-player game, 2 of the characters, I think, will be face up, 1 will be face down or something, or 2 face down. So, you know, some of the characters are not in play, so there's some like little deduction happening there. But basically on your turn, you can take 2 gold or draw 2 cards and keep 1, so you get resources. And then you can optionally build a building card from your hand. And buildings are how you score points. Buildings are what triggers the end of the game. Like once somebody has their 7th building in their district, that's going to trigger the end of the game. There are 5 different types of buildings. And each roll card has this like bonus ability. So like, for example, there's a merchant. And if you are the merchant, you get to gain an extra gold. And then you get a gold for each of your trade buildings, which are the green icon buildings. And then like there's an architect that instead of just building 1 building on your turn, you can build up to 3 and you get an extra building card. And then there's a thief, and the thief could say who they want to rob. I'm robbing the king this round because maybe I think Matt is the king and I see he has like 3 gold. So I'm trying to figure out who Matt is so I can rob Matt. And then, you know, there are all these different like fun roles. And I think the main reason I like introducing this to my friends who are non-gamers, who are kind of game curious, is because it's really fun. Like, you know, choosing your character each round, like once people get the hang of that and how all of the different characters work, you know, the actual like mechanism, I guess, of playing the building cards is like you spend gold and you put the card down. You know, there are some like unique mm-hmm. buildings that maybe will have a little power on it, but most of them are just like you pay for the building, it's there. And whatever the cost on the building is, that's how many points it's going to generate at the end of the game. And there's some bonus points if you have one of each type of building. But yeah, I just find this game to be just very fun forward. Like it's always like, you know, with that assassin role and the thief, it just adds some just spice and intrigue. You can do some bluffing. And I found that everybody I introduced this game to just really enjoys it. And it's still like, you know, even like, I don't know how many games I have or how many games I've played at this point because I don't log my plays yet. But I just, it stays on my shelf and it comes out every once in a while and there's lots of laughter at the table. So that is Citadels.
Yeah, this one takes, it's more explanation than you want to start. But if somebody is eager enough to sit through it, you won't really have a problem after that. It just seems like a lot to start. And that's the only thing you have to be careful of is, you know, maybe with something like this, it could be really great once you get them going. You just might have to think about how you're going to explain it.
And, you know, this is another one where it's like, who is your audience? You know, knowing your audience, because I think, like, I think at this point I would teach it to my mom.
But you feel like you've leveled her to that.
I think we're getting there. But then I have other friends who, you know, they caught on to it. You know, they don't like have a board game collection, but they caught on to it. So I think it's like, you know, knowing you're the right audience. I also don't know that my mom would enjoy this. Like, I don't know that it's her thing, you know?
Yes. Whereas typing matters.
Is her thing, you know? But yes, you definitely, there is, this one is a little, you have to, the right new audience for it. But that's Citadels. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's a great one again, really leaning into like clean asymmetry. Like, what does it mean to take on each role? Because as you said, the other part's pretty straightforward and easy. You probably already played plenty of stuff like that, or you get the basic premise that this is the new part.
The role selection. Right? Yep.
All right. So it's funny. I didn't realize how many of mine were going to be co-ops this time, because I'll be honest, like, co-ops are not always my thing.
But they're good for you know introducing what I mean? People.
There's something about them. They are. They keep it social. They spread it out. So this is another one that is really good to onboard people to a lot at once, but they won't realize how much it is.
Nice.
And it can kind of grow a little bit. That's the best way to put this. So the next one I have on here is Horrified. I will say the cards are going to be the thing that people have issues with when they first play this game. So, you know, we're talking about Citadels has a lot of rules to start. Understanding those cards that you draw in the game is going to be my watch out for this one. That you want to, you know, as the person who's already played, you're definitely going to want to facilitate that part. But what's really cool about this game is that it is a co-op game where you are communicating the whole time, but you have independent turns. You're working together to basically take on some kind of combination of monsters, and you can tune the monster sets to the level of difficulty you want.
Oh, that's cool.
So what's already cool about this is there's a recommended, hey, maybe start with these guys because they're easier. Right. And so stuff like that is already a great thing to walk in with other people. What's also neat is each of the monsters has a slightly different mechanic. So what, even though I know I already said don't introduce people to more than one mechanic at a time, what's kind of neat about these is that the focus is a little different because we're doing it together. So each monster has one way to destroy them and one way for them to win. Basically something about like something that makes them unique in the way that they act. So maybe they move a particular way. Maybe they, you know, need to have a particular objective. We don't need to know what all of them are because we're only going to take on, you know, a couple at a time here. What becomes really good about this is that, again, a little bit of asymmetry. Each of our players has like one power. But really what we're doing is can have those bigger conversations about how do we take on this type of mechanic? How do we maximize, get through it? And what's really cool about this, and this is something you don't necessarily think about unless you teach games a lot, is it shows a ton of modeled thinking. Now, what modeled thinking is I'm going to talk about why I did what I did so that you now understand the strategy behind it. Because it takes playing a lot of games to accumulate that much strategy, to already see what the right move is. Nor, like, the average player doesn't have that yet. What's really neat about a game like Horrified is you can talk through as a group how you're going to maximize and take down each of these monsters individually, which means you're thinking about each mechanic and how you're going to basically stop it. Right? So what's really nice about this one is that it's going to introduce players really quickly to a lot, but it's just enough that it's not too much, as long as you're helping facilitate, as I said, the things that are not as easy to understand. So there is iconography across the bottom of the cards that makes sense when you get it, but it looks like absolute nonsense when you don't. Right. And so you kind of need, again, that player who's going to say, all right, it says these characters are frenzied and these two are moving and this one bad thing just happened to us, or this one good thing just happened to us. You just need someone who's going to help basically explain gamer stuff a little bit. And so this game is a nice introduction to a little bit of a lot without seeming like it's overwhelming you, because you don't have to do it all at once.
Cool. Horrified. Yeah, I have not played this one. This is another one I'd be curious to try at some point, maybe around Halloween or something.
Again, yeah, if you don't like monster themes, you know, we're talking about themes that might turn someone off. This is a 50-50. This is either going to be a yay or nay, right? Like, based on, hey, you want to take on, like, classic Universal monsters?
Yeah, but if somebody, but if you do know somebody who's, like, you know, doesn't play board games much and loves that theme, this would be a great game.
This is a really fast intro to lots of different things. But again, just enough that you don't feel overwhelmed, because what you're really seeing is an individual monster board. You're seeing a little puzzle, right, on the mummy. You're seeing a kind of like a color pattern game for the monster from the Black Lagoon. You're seeing kind of more like a pick up and deliver thing going on with some of them. It's micro versions of hobby games. And so if you can get someone to understand the different monsters in Horrified, you've just onboarded them to a whole bunch of mechanics that you can now springboard from.
Cool. That's awesome. That's awesome. So my next game is Azul. Azul is a 2017 release from Michael Kiesling, Next Move Games, plays with 2 to 4 players. And it is a game where you're drafting these different color/pattern tiles off these little coaster boards, and then you're going to be putting them onto your own player board and trying to kind of complete a puzzle. And
you're playing with Kala. Let's just call it what it is, but that's what makes it easy. You're playing with Kala.
The tiles are beautiful and they feel great. So, like, that's something that's going to be appealing to people who aren't used to modern games. It's just like having a good tactile experience and just having something nice to look at and nice to feel. And you're basically scoring points based on how you're placing your tiles on your boards. It's a, you know, straight up draft these tiles and try to make your puzzle, complete your puzzle as best as possible, better than the other players. And one of the things that Eric and I were talking about before we started recording, when I mentioned this game, is just the scoring of this game is probably going to be the most challenging thing for people to get.
Yeah. Just stick with make the pretty picture. If you stick with that, you're good.
But yeah, I think it's cool because it kind of introduces people to like a drafting experience. Like, you're picking something from the center. And that's impacting what other people are going to be able to pick. And it's also like there are a lot of people who like a good puzzle. And, you know, aside from the scoring, I think it is something that just about anyone with the right teacher can grok, you know?
Oh, I agree. Because I think there's something very visually, it's visually pretty. It's tactilely pretty, as you said. Like, you know, it's great to touch the tiles. People inherently kind of get Mikala drafting. Again, we don't call it that, but if they get Mikala, right? The scoring is brutal, but you can, you know, introduce to someone to that at the end and be like, hey, you scored this, but don't worry so much about that. Look what you built.
Exactly. So I had to put Azul on here, and this is one, going back to my mom, as a like baseline for introducing someone to modern games. I bought her Azul and I played Azul with her, and I don't know that it's something that she pulls out regularly with other people, you know, but she can play it and she did like it, so that's cool.
Man, it makes a pretty picture. It's fun to photograph when you're done, right? So I kind of wanted to give an entire card company their own number here.
Love it.
Because I don't think you can go wrong. I don't think you can go wrong in this. And you have decades to pull from. So my number two recommendation is pretty much anything Amigo.
I love it.
I mean, we already mentioned Six Nimmit, right? It could be like, I think they're No Thanks as well, but I mean, you've got like, how big was Llama a couple of years ago? How big was Bonanza?
Oh, yeah.
Love
Bonanza.
Right? I mean, if you love Scout is kind of take like that. That's where Bonanza started, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's where a lot of that stuff comes from. If you ever, okay. Crybaby is an awesome game. Armadillo is fun. Oh, there's so many fun ones. And the great thing is they're all roughly the same size box game. Majority are cards. Some are cards with a couple dice. They all do one mechanic, like almost impeccably clean. You will learn that mechanic almost perfectly, right? Like it is just such an, the theming will always be something fun that gets your attention, even if it's meaningless. Yep. Like Crybaby is a game where you're basically playing onions. and the entire point of the game is that you want to play cards on your pile, but you can't play cards if the card you want to play can actually go onto either pile on the person to your left or right. So then what you have to do is you either have to give them one of the cards, which you really don't want to do, or you're going to actually have to play one of your cards upside down so you get a fresh pile. The problem is for every one of these you do, you have to count them at the end. So for example, if you happen to do four of them, any fours you've collected are now have no value. Right? So there's a really neat thing that builds slowly. Across the board, you can't go wrong introducing people to like 99.9% of Amigo games and get them to keep playing another game with you when you're done.
Good recommendation.
I really don't think you can go wrong. I think Bonanza is probably the hardest one I can think of, only because you are now at a couple different things happening that people are not used to. So first is that hand management. So if you've ever played Scout, where the order of your cards has to stay that way, Bonanza's been doing that for like 20 years or whatever it is.
You're trading beans.
Your cards have to stay in order. Yeah, your cards have to stay in order. You are set collecting in front of you. But you also have a really neat side mechanic, which I thought I love, that you almost benefit from giving cards away to other people. Like you want to be generous because that's how you actually set your hand up into a perfect order. So if you can get rid of cards from your hands because someone else is willing to take it at the end of their turn, all of a sudden maybe you have the perfect cards in sequence that you can now play. So there's this weird thing where helping other people can actually be a huge benefit to you if you can do it properly. But just across the board, if you see Amigo on a box, you're just safe. If I think to grab just about any of those games, and they have them in so many different languages, but there's a reason they're like go-to card games. They are just so accessible. They do mechanics usually incredibly clean. They have really fun or silly, theming, but you're almost guaranteed to have a good time playing just about any of them, and they won't take you long to explain.
Cool. Anything Amigo. I love it. So my next game on my list is probably the game that I've introduced to the most people that got them excited, like really excited about board games, and they are borderline addicted to this game, and I don't know if they still are, but
another good tactile game too.
It is Splendor. Splendor is just a banger. It came out in 2014, designed by Marc Andre. It's published by Space Cowboys. Plays with 2 to 4 players, and you know this is a game where theme is loose, but it's all about collecting these gems and then using these gems to buy cards. And when you buy cards, the cards you're building into your tableau are giving you a discount on future cards that you're buying, and you are racing to get to 15 points because there are some cards that are like higher tier cards that you can buy that actually have points on them. And I forget how you lock in one of those nobles. Like, I think you need a combination of a certain amount of different color cards built.
Yeah, each one has like a something that they're looking for in combination. And so if you get that, you get to claim them for
Yeah, but it's, you know, you're racing to 15 points. Like, it's a great tactile experience. Like, the gems are these nice poker chips. I'm sure most people listening to this podcast have probably played Splendor. But I just think it's a great game to introduce people to the hobby. I have people who, like, I have friends who are like, no, I don't like board games. And then, like, you know, we're at Thanksgiving and you break out Splendor and they're like, oh, I like that, you know? And then they want to play it again. It's a hooky game. You know, think like a hooky melody in a song where you can't stop singing it. Like, people want to, especially new gamers, when they get into Splendor, you want to kind of keep playing it. I think it's because the engine building is so satisfying, like collecting cards that give me a discount and let me get better cards that are giving me points. Like, there's a little rush to it. And, you know, again, the components are great. So it's a good looking game. It plays, you know, in 30 minutes.
It plays fast, yeah. Too.
So yeah. I think Splendor is a great game to introduce people to.
I would agree. And again, another beautifully visual, tactile game. There's something about weighted clay tiles.
Yeah, there's chips.
Like, if you have the nice version. They're really nice. And it's quick because you're basically just like, okay, I'll take that one. And, like, you don't even have to know what you're doing at first. You're just like, I'm going to take that one. Splendor Duel, if you get a chance, is also great. I think it's a really nice streamline of this as well.
Yeah, if you're playing with just one-on-one with somebody, yep.
Yeah, if you want like a smaller version of this, you know, also doesn't look super intimidating. As you said, it doesn't even look exactly like a board game when you set this up, because basically you have a square board with a whole lot of chips.
Yeah.
Right? And I think there's something to that. Think about how a game sets up visually, because though we might look at something and go, oh my God, look at all the parts. Other people are like, holy crap, look at all the parts.
Yeah. that's funny, but that's true. And also I think, you know, the other thing you could do on your turn besides buying a card or getting those gems is to reserve a card. And I think that's a really cool option too, because it's like you see something and you're like, oh, well, I don't want them to get that, but I can't quite afford it right now. You have that option to take that card, and it just gives a little player interaction, you know? And the gem colors are limited too. So sometimes you might want something that's not available. But yeah, that's Splendor. So what's your last game or collection of games?
Yes. Okay. I will say that I have used these to play games with, like, I can't even tell you how many different people, because this is the types of games that you can literally pull out of your bag anywhere you go, and they will give you such a variety, but oh my God, they're always good. So my number one pick, if you want to onboard people to the hobby, is Get Anything Oink. So the reason I say this is because I feel like they are micro hobby games in a box, but there's such a good variety amongst what they are that they're also super accessible. Some of them are party games in disguise. Some are filler. Some are push your luck. Some are, you know, honestly, like, you know, look how into you can get into Scout or let's say Deep Sea Adventure, but they're still not over your head.
Right.
Right. There's something super easy about them when they come out of the box. They don't scare you. Right. Like, think about if a, you know, non-Japanese publisher had done Deep Sea Adventure. I want you to think about how big that game would actually look. Right.
Yeah.
And so, but when you pull out something like Deep Sea Adventure, you've got a tiny, you know, tiny little box. All Oink games are the same size box. They're all quite small except for Money Bags. They're like almost like pocket games. You can take them anywhere you go. You can usually explain them in a few sentences, and you just have such a variety of experiences. Like, I mean, you can pull out Fake Artists or Insider or Money Bags or, you know, Nine Tile Panic anywhere, or Tama Tomato or something stupid. But then, you know what? Hey, that person seems like they've got a little bit more that they're grasping. Let's go on to something else. Let's do a Deep Sea Adventure. Let's do Scout. Let's do something where you've got that little bit crunchier happening. But within that range alone, not only will none of these games scare anybody when you pull this out, there's nothing scary about these games in any way. You're going to have just a really nice variety of experiences that most people will say, okay, because it's a little box. It's not intimidating.
Yeah.
Right? It looks like it's going to be this super easy experience. And we all know from hobby, ultimately, all these games are easy once you get them. But you got to get someone who says, I'm willing to learn. There is something about tiny oink boxes that does not turn people off. And there's a lot of game in that little box, right? I think they are one of the perfect games for onboarding people. They're one of those games, like, I can't tell you how many copies of Scout I've given away.
That's cool.
Right? Because they're like, somebody likes it. It's, you know, it's fits in your hand. You know, you're like, keep it. Right, I'll get another one. Because that is now a game they're going to go teach to so many other people. And there's something about these small box games. That's why I also said Amigo. I can't tell you how many copies of Llama I've given away or other things like that. Because you introduce it to a group and they really enjoy it. And if they have that game, they're likely to go play it more.
Yeah.
Right? Or go buy more or go play it with their friends. Like, we want them to play games. Bust out some oil.
I love it. I love it. I've never actually played Fake Artist. I love Insider. I love Scout. But yeah, they're
you probably played Fake Artist and didn't realize it. I'll be honest. These games get ripped off like crazy.
Oh, so I...
I'm not really going to get into that so much. But I promise you probably played some of these experiences, especially when some of these games were harder to get.
Gotcha.
A lot of people maybe borrowed the game, play a little bit. But we'll... just say they're all really solid
cool,
games.
Cool, cool. Yeah, I definitely love Insider, and I've introduced that to a lot of people who then love that as well. So that's great. Anything oink, or Amigo. So my last game is actually a group of games too. So we kind of did the same thing here, but mine is just cooperative board games in general. So I didn't go with necessarily...
which is definitely been a theme noticed.
So, I mean, you were thinking along the same lines as me, but I just think cooperative games, you know, whether it's something lighter, like Forbidden Island, which actually, like, when I was new, I remember I bought it just because it was either recommended, and I did not understand how to play that game. So, like, this is definitely something where, you know, someone should know how to play the game. But Mysterium, and then again, like Dorf Fromantic. I won't go into my thoughts on that per se, because I'm going to do this Spiel des Jahres video and everything. But I, you know, regardless of my thoughts, I think that it's a good game for, you know, it's a cooperative game. Everybody's working together against the game. And, you know, for a lot of people, it just feels good to work as a team and not have that like stress of, hey, I don't want to make a mistake or look dumb or lose or whatever. But like, when the minute you start playing something together, it just kind of flips it on its head. Yeah,
that shared win. Right?
Yeah, that shared loss, but like just experience, you know, like you said earlier, like just having an experience together. It's a different experience playing a cooperative game than a competitive game. And I think that is just a great way, because also a lot of people who aren't in the hobby yet might not even know cooperative games exist. So, like, they'll be, like, mind blown when you're like, hey, you know, there are, like, a ton of board games that we can play together and work together.
Yeah.
And
they might – that's a great point. They might think that board games are mean. Like, if you really only ever played, let's say, like, Sorry, Monopoly, something like that, think of the impression you're going to have of board games.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. So tell people about cooperative board games.
We can work together.
totally. So, Erica, like, that was, I'm really glad you suggested this topic. And, you know, for me, it was actually really well timed, also coming off of BGG Spring, where, again, there are a lot of families there. So it's exciting to see people bringing their children to game conventions and showing them games and kind of getting them into the hobby early. Like, I played a game of Project L for the first time, which is another good intro game, but with a family who was there, and it was really cool. You know, I don't remember the guy's name, but he was like, yeah, I'll teach you. And I just love that, like, friendliness and people willing to teach games to other people that they have played and they enjoy and everything. But he was there with his family, and it was like, he was telling me how, like, you know, during the pandemic, they played a game every week together. And I was like, that's awesome. So talking about just how can we do better at getting more people into the hobby, and like what are some games that are great for it is, I don't know, it's exciting. It's exciting.
Yeah, we want people to play with us. We want them. We want to get them to the 3-hour game. We just don't want to scare them with the 3-hour game, right? So, and that's kind of the major takeaway. We want more people to join the hobby. The more people who play, it's not just more buyers. It's a bigger community. It's potentially more designers, more people who want to publish, more people who want to get into art. There's so many things that bring people into gaming that it'd be really nice, you know, if everybody gets to see what we see. But we don't want to scare them.
Yes, we have to approach it gently.
You know, it's like if you were going to try to explain like a TCG to somebody, you know, you wouldn't get into like explaining how all of these cards individually work. Goodness. You're going to explain the basic premise of how the game plays, right? Like you just have to kind of think about how you're presenting that, because we not only want more people join the hobby, we don't want more articles saying, I don't want to go to your game.
Yeah, we don't. That's not good. Anyways, Erica, it is always awesome to talk to you. I hope that you'll be at some conventions later this year.
I'm at San Diego Comic Con and Gen Con, I think, are my only next two. Maybe New York Toy Fair. I don't know.
I'll see potentially you at Gen New York Con. Toy Fair. We'll have to do lunch again.
Yes.
Cool. Thanks so much for joining me. And I hope you enjoy the rest of your week.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Board Game Geek podcast, produced and edited by Candace Harris. Special thanks to Matt Fonda for editing and mixing our music. Be sure to visit us on the web at BoardGameGeek.com. You can also find us on YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and Twitch under Board Game Geek. You can reach us by email at podcast@boardgamegeek.com. Thanks for listening, and happy gaming!